Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this balmy March 1st. Let's see if it comes in like a lion or something. I don't know. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2691. Mr. Administrator, will you tell us what that one's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2691 authorizes non-resident nurses licensed and in good standing in another state to provide volunteer services related to the practice of nursing in this state under specified circumstances.
We have a Dastry Amendment. Can you tell us what that's all about?
The Dastry Amendments delete provisions that were relating to physicians, clarifies that non-resident nurses practicing under the statute may not prescribe drugs unless approved by the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and limits non-resident nurses to 2 temporary assignments not to exceed 5 days in a 12-month period.
And is my understanding correct that there's no opposition to this?
I've not received any opposition.
It's a work session, but is anybody in opposition to this bill? I'm glad to hear what you have to say. Okay, then I think we're ready for an amendment.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. The amendment removes the reference to physicians. I was just curious why, where it came from.
I think they're already in statute.
Oh, they're already in statute. Okay.
Does that
do it with rules?
Hmm? Yeah, I think that's the reason.
Okay, thank you.
Ready for a motion?
Ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dastry amendments to House Bill 2691, dated 2/25/13.
Representative Thompson moves the Dastry amendments to House Bill 2691, dated 2/25/13. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Dastries are a part of House Bill 2691.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2691 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2691 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion about this? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Excuse.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Bidley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Green?
Aye. Motion passes. Do we have a carrier for this?
You're the sponsor.
I will carry it.
Okay.
We'll wait till we get a couple more back, and we just passed the bill. We'll wait till we get a couple more back, and then we'll have a motion to allow y'all to vote on it. I'm going to hold House Bill 2902 to the last item of the agenda. We've got at least 15 or more people who want to testify, and we'll have the time related to how much time we have left. I think we'll have more time if we do it at the end. So we'll work through the other parts of the agenda and then do 2902. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2280. And Congress, is this your bill?
It is. And could we wait for Representative Hoyle? She was.
Oh, sure. Okay. We'll keep that open. Would you let Representative Hoyle know that we'll take testimony on that whenever she comes down? Oh, is she coming? That's the question. You will. If you call her and tell her whenever she comes, we'll be ready to take testimony on that bill. We'll leave that public hearing open. And you may have something to say on 2724 as well. Is that right?
She's here to testify.
Hmm?
Her LA is here to testify.
Are you going to testify on that? Okay. I'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2724. What's that bill about, Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2724 adds dental practice to a list of medical practices which can be certified by the Department of Consumer and Business Services as a retainer medical practice. It authorizes DCBS to investigate and take enforcement actions with respect to dental provider maintaining or purporting to maintain a retainer dental practice and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Please introduce yourself.
For the record, Courtney Johnston, legislative aide to State Representative Val Hoyle, House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. Here to testify today on House Bill 2724, which, just to inform you, this bill allows the Department of Consumer Business Services to certify a retainer dental practice in the same way that Oregon already allows for retainer medical practice. A retainer practice charges a monthly or annual fee under terms of a contract in exchange for services. As many of you, nationally, about half the population is without dental insurance, and that number, Oregon's numbers have also been increasing. Representative Hoyle introduced this bill because she knows that oral health is an integral dimension of our overall physical health and well-being. The consequences of poor oral health access and care include complications of major chronic conditions, pain, impacts on children's growth and social development, nutrition problems, late detection of oral cancers, loss of teeth, missed school days and work, expensive emergency room use for preventable dental conditions, and tragically, sometimes untreated oral disease leads to death. Oregon Dental Care in Eugene has developed a dental plan which offers discounted services for a fee and addresses the needs of uninsured residents in Lane County. This bill was introduced in order to allow Oregon Dental to offer a retainer plan. And so that's why we're here today. So thank you for allowing me to come and introduce this bill to you.
No other DCBS supports the bill?
I don't think that they're against. I don't know if they support it or are neutral on it. We've worked with them in order to come up with the way to promote it or to put into statute. So
there's DCBS right here.
Are they here?
Thank you.
Hi, Lou.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lou Savage, Insurance Commissioner. We don't have a position on the bill. I can tell you then when the bill was originally passed, Senate Bill 86, dental was in the original bill. So it was taken out with an amendment.
Okay. And have you seen the Dash 1 amendments to the bill?
We have. Yeah, we don't have any problem with the amendment.
Okay, great. Are there any questions to this panel? Sam Clem?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Courtney, aren't you the one that used to put that Oregon duck over the podium? You moved down the hall, I noticed, but it was looking at me all the time.
We're going to have a civil war right here.
I'd knock it down. She'd put it back up. I'd knock it down. Have you ever testified in front of the committee before? No?
There are consequences to your behavior.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Clem, the duck is still in my office.
You moved away from me.
The colors are interesting.
Is that for him?
I think you missed the duck. I missed Courtney, not the duck.
We've got Courtney, maybe you'll hang around just in case, huh? We've got we have Russ House, Doug Barber. Yep, we have you guys.
He's
surrounded by computer guys.
He just walked in.
Hey, come back.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm Doug Barber here today on behalf of Willamette Dental. As you heard, this issue started last session in 2011 with Senate Bill 86, the medical retainer bill. When that bill was first introduced, it included dental services. We opposed that bill for the same reason we oppose this bill, and that is that the way it's written, it would pretty much allow all dental insurance to be written under retainer, the new retainer statutes, which means you would do away with the consumer protections that we've come to expect in dental insurance. No reserves, no mandates, no consumer protections. We don't think that's the policy decision that you want to make. We don't think that was the right policy decision 2 years ago, which was why we worked with the insurance division to come up with an amendment to exclude dental from Senate Bill 86. We think that policy was the right one 2 years ago. We think that's still the right policy decision. We understand the issues that are driving this bill. The dentist in Eugene who has a plan that he wants to put forward and sell is very similar to the kind of plan that Willamette Dental started with when it started. And I'll let my colleague get into the details of that. But I think the bottom line is Dr. Colby doesn't need a bill. He needs he needs an insurance license. Thank you.
I'm Russell House. I'm with Willamette Dental. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. When we try to relate this to who we are and where we came from, there are some similarities. We started out as a dental practice in 1970, and we started working on capitation basis with Blue Cross back in the mid-70s. Then we decided to try what House Bill 2724 contemplates, capitation. And we were advised by CBS at the time that we had to have an insurance license. At that time, we were a small practice. We obtained our insurance license, and we're operating under that insurance license today. House Bill 2724 would overturn existing standing law of insurance. I've attached an insurance bulletin to my testimony that explains why capitation does constitute the transaction of insurance, essentially an agreement between one or more healthcare providers and one or more purchasers constitutes the transaction of insurance if the providers are compensated for the actual or potential delivery of healthcare services in a manner that involves risk sharing, such as capitation, fixed or global payments, or other similar arrangements. In this arrangement, an insured pays a fixed periodic payment to the provider in exchange for provider's assumption of risk to deliver an unpredictable volume of services and to absorb an unknown future cost for that population. And dental, we understand, is modest, but dentistry fundamentally is primary care. And this bill permits unfettered delivery of primary care services without an insurance policy. And these plans can be modest. Our first plan was very modest. It was $50 a year for premium, and that was 25, 30 years ago. The covered member could receive an annual exam, cleaning, and x-rays for this fee. All other services were at a discounted fee-for-service basis. That constituted the transaction of insurance and has been the transaction of insurance under settled law in this state and all other states that we're familiar with. Some of the protections that DCBS provides include the filing of policy forms that have to be reviewed and approved by DCBS and that have to include state and federal coverage mandates. And individual plan rates have to be filed with DCBS for approval. The carrier has to meet and maintain regulated financial reserves and solvency requirements. Has to submit financial statements and undergo strict scrutiny through audits of market conduct and financial health. Because we have to comply with insurance law, we've had to turn away business. There was a group on the coast that did not want to have domestic partner coverage, which is a mandate under your Oregon state law. DCBS effects that mandate by requiring the domestic partner coverage to be included in all insurance policies that are issued. The group asked us to go direct, do in effect retainer dental practice with them, because their group did not want the domestic policy coverage. We had to say no because the assumption of risk is the transaction of insurance, so we could not operate our program without issuing an insurance policy. If we have to issue an insurance policy, then we have to comply with the mandates, including the domestic partner coverage. So we turned that business down. We testified in 2011 against SB 86 retainer medical practice, and dental was excluded. Dental should continue to be excluded. As I indicated, dentistry is primary care, and HB 2724 permits unfettered primary care agreements with consumers. In effect, the legislature would be creating an unregulated insurance product for dentistry. The creation of a new and slanted playing field is inherently unfair and not in the best interests of consumers.
Any questions on this?
Yes.
Excuse me. Could you join us again? I think we may have some questions for you.
Could you refresh my memory on why we left
Lou. Lou, Mr. Savage.
Dental out of the last bill? I do remember it was in there. I don't remember the reason why we differentiated that from physician care.
Well, Representative Thompson, frankly, we testified against the bill on the basis that it constituted the transaction of insurance. The Division of Insurance, DCBS, as I recall, indicated that exceptions could be made. We indicated that for the same reasons we're testifying today, that we had a problem with that, especially with respect to dental. We don't do medical, so at that point, it was carved out.
So we worked with them on the amendment, and that was the agreement, was the best way to resolve it was to carve dental out.
Okay.
Are you going to talk to us about it? Yes, because I have some questions about
it. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeanette Holman from the Insurance Division. Lou had to run to Portland, so I'm the backstop today.
I'm sure you'll be backstopping very adequately. My assumption is that these retainer practices, that they charge a certain amount per month or per year, as you suggested, starting. I mean, do you have a feeling that that's not insurance? I mean, if we don't pass this, are they covered by insurance? I mean, are they required to be insurance companies?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they would be considered insurance without this bill, because that's why we enacted the Medical Retainer Act last session, was because those kinds of arrangements would otherwise fall within the insurance code. And to get them out, we had to pass the bill.
And have you had a chance to look at the Dash 3 amendments?
The Dash 3? Or the Dash 1?
Dash 1, I'm sorry.
Yes.
And would that adequately eliminate the requirement for dental retainer plans to be covered under the insurance code?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would.
Other questions? Is there somebody here who knows something about how this plan operates that we could hear from you? Thank you, guys. Maybe you can hang. You're going to be hanging around.
I will not go anywhere.
Is there anybody that can talk to us about how this particular plan operates? Can you do that?
About the retainer plan.
The plan that's asked us to exclude them.
Okay. The Oregon Dental.
What do they charge? What do they cover? What's the issue in terms of the substance like?
Well, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, Courtney Johnston, Representative Hoyles, Legislative Aid. The Oregon Dental Care Plan provides insured members 100% of their benefits via immediate discounts given at the time of treatment. They engage a nationally recognized dental actuary to create the plan with a 90% probability of being overfunded. This is a written statement from Dr. Lee Colby of the Oregon Dental Care.
They use actuaries to calculate their premium?
It offers premiums 50% to 6% lower. I will submit this for the record.
Why don't we do this?
And then we'll do that, and you guys can...
Why don't we close this hearing and reopen it when we can get somebody from the plan to come in?
And I apologize, Dr. Colby couldn't make it today, so thank you.
I will close public hearing on House Bill 2724, and we'll wait to hear from somebody from the plan who can come and talk to us, explain why it shouldn't be insurance. Did Clem disappear again?
He did. He's probably right outside.
If he is, we'll give him a chance to vote. Well, all right. Let's move on. I don't see Representative Hoyle. Am I missing it? You want to go ahead and...
I answer. Sure. I can.
The public hearing remains open on House Bill 2280. We'll get some testimony on that bill. Yeah. You want to tell us what it's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2280 modifies the definition of qualified employer and authorized continuation of coverage for an employee who is enrolled in the program whose employment terminates. And that's referring to health care improvement programs.
Go for it.
For the record, Jason Conger, House District 54, which is Bend. This bill, the description is accurate, but it's not very specific to what the bill actually does. Briefly, I was hoping that Rep. Hoyle could be here because she has actually worked pretty extensively with a substantially identical program in, I think she said in Lane County, although I'm not 100% sure, and I think she would have more, would be more descriptive about what the plan actually, it's not a plan, what the program actually does. But I can give you kind of a sense anyway without that much personal experience. Briefly, let me just describe what the bill actually does, because it's very, very simple. There, by statute, the legislature permitted the formation of what in Central Oregon is called shared care, which is a multi-share product that's aimed at addressing people who are uninsured but employed. And I can't remember what year that passed, but it was a few years ago. And all this does is modify the definition of a qualified employee in a way that is more responsive to what employers are actually typically in the plan need. So, for example, the modification of the definition changes it from an employer who, qualified employer, an employer who employs 1 to 50 employees to an employer who employs 1 to 50 full-time equivalent employees, which was more consistent with the intent of the legislature, I think. Obviously, that changes so that you don't have one part-time employee. You have to have full-time employees. The other is to shorten the time frame prior to enrollment, which the employer who's involved in the program would have provided employer insurance coverage for employees. And it goes from 12 months to 2 months. And the reason is because this is, again, focused on providing this product for people who don't have health insurance. And very often, what they're finding in the St. Charles administers this product. What they're finding is, that employers are in distress and they are canceling their insurance for their employees. And so there's a greater need to pick up nearer term, you know, not wait 12 months, but pick up within 2 months so that people don't lose insurance coverage completely. And that's...
The operational part, I think, is on page 2, line 39. It talks about essentially a COBRA-like.
The right. So the idea here with this change is to change the dues amount. One of the calls that may elect to continue enrollment after losing employment with the employer who is enrolled in this program. The employee can continue the community-based healthcare improvement program, which is what this is. It's not insurance. But they can remain in the program by picking up the amount that was being paid to have them in the program. So it doesn't allow an increase in the charge above what the program or the product, whatever you want to call it, what the shared care would have charged to have them in the program. But it allows them to continue coverage after otherwise they wouldn't be eligible. And again, this is to pick up need specific to the economic environment and the nature of the product. I'm going to just close briefly, but obviously I didn't give a great description, but I think Representative Hoyle is going to be able to describe what this product is, and I apologize for avoiding that, but I was actually filibustering and trying to delay.
It worked.
Success.
The Mounties rode in.
Val Hoyle, I represent House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City, and thank you for hearing our testimony here today, and thank you for filibustering. Excellent.
I'm a master at it.
Yes. One of the reasons I'm testifying on this is previous to coming to the legislature, I was the director of the 100% Access Coalition at the United Way of Lane County, and we had a program that we started in Lane County, in Central Oregon, and in Northeast Oregon, based on a federal grant, to find a program that wasn't insurance but provided access at an affordable rate and health coverage, access to health care for an undoctored, uninsured population. And really, it was the population of people between 140 and 300% of the federal poverty level, basically the working poor, small businesses, where they couldn't afford access to health care, they didn't have access to primary care. This undoctored population tended to be rather unhealthy. For instance, in Lane County, with one of the programs that we set up, we found that on average, the people that we saw, and again, these are people that are working, working poor, had not seen a doctor in 5 years, and 67% of them had diabetes, prediabetes, or hypertension. So one of the programs, the way that we had it set up with this federal grant was that Central Oregon would go out first, and they were the first ones to go out to companies to talk to them about the program. And the way that this program worked, again, it's not health insurance, but rather access to health care, is that there is an equal amount paid by the employee, by the employer, and then by the multi-share program. So it's a three-tier program. And they would have an initial health assessment, and there were a set of a program, and Chair Greenlick, I'm sure you're familiar with it, the Pathways program, where whether it be losing weight or smoking cessation or exercise or, you know, medication, there was a set of criteria set out in order to get employees invested in healthier lifestyles and, again, access to health care. If the employees chose not to participate in those programs, then they paid a higher copay or payment per month, and their employer paid a higher payment per month. It was incredibly successful, and again, Central Oregon was the first, and shared care was the first program to get out of the gate. Very successful for the small population. Since that time, the outlines of the grant changed, and of course the Affordable Care Act came through, so the needs became different. But the need for the population to access this type of health care, the need for that population, and again, even if these people are not in their job, they finally got into a place where they can access primary care and get access to assistance to have healthy lifestyles. So in the end, we are saving money, and we're also asking people to take on personal responsibility with guidance, with help. And this program was set up so that they could only have access to it while they worked in this particular, in the job, but much like we have COBRA, to take people away from the healthcare access in this program when it has been so successful seemed counterproductive to what we're trying to do in health transformation, which is to get a healthier population. So what this bill asks is that, we define the qualified employer and allow for continuation of coverage of, COBRA-like benefits, and also change a few of the things. For instance, increasing the amount of employees you can have to 50 employees.
To full-time equivalents.
To full-time equivalents instead of just full-time. So there's a number of things that slightly change what the original bill is to allow for this program to continue. It's been successful. It's a small piece, but I don't believe that health transformation can happen in one big bite, and I believe that this type of program, this type of support, the small changes here will benefit a population and a group and a community that has done really well in providing access to health care.
And if I can just, one detail that I think both of us missed, thank you, by the way, for filling that in. I was floundering. Yeah, that was ugly. The shortening of the time frame allows for continuity of coverage under HIPAA. Again, similar to COBRA, people who go who don't have health insurance, I believe, for 2 months, then can be denied insurance because of pre-existing conditions. Otherwise, if it's within the maximum of the 2 months, they have continuity of coverage and they can't be denied. And so it's leaving them in the program allows them to have that more opportunity to get another job, get back insured one way or another. And final point is, this really is, and I think you said this, it's a gap filler. It's in between the safety net programs, OHP, and employer-provided or individual insurance policies for a group of working poor, which comprise about a quarter of our uninsured population, at least in Central Oregon. And it has been successful. I think, by the way, it's temporary, because I think the Affordable Care Act and our health insurance exchange are going to change the landscape. But until then, we'd like to keep this going and keep these people healthy.
This, I think I heard you say this was three-part payment by the employer program and the individual. Would they keep paying the other two-thirds share of this after they left employment?
The
individual only pays their share? I mean, it sounds like that.
My understanding is it's only the employee, but I would have to.
And who's going
to
pay the rest of
it? Hey, that's my question.
Well, the program and employee probably.
Yeah, the program at this point is self-funded. I don't believe that it's receiving any more money from the state. It was funded initially, I think, with a federal grant, wasn't it?
It was a federal grant, and that federal grant ended. And so we can certainly get back to you with that information. I do not believe that the employer will be, once an employee leaves the employ, that the employer will need to be paying a portion of that. But the initial multi-share program, and again, it has changed since the beginning when we actually came before this committee, and I believe it was in 2009 or 2010 to get this initial bill. But I do not believe that that it is set up exactly the same way, but it initially came out as that three-part program. But we can certainly get back to you.
I actually know the answer.
Oh.
The answer is it's self-funded now. In Central Oregon, anyway, it is the program is operated by St. Charles. So the employee picks up the employee amount, continues to pick up the employee amount. The employer no longer contributes its part, and the program picks up the employer's part so that the employee, who is presumably still low income, can afford to stay in the program.
And just to add, the Lane County and Northeast Oregon, because we hadn't gotten as far along before the federal funding amounts and requirements changed, we went in a different direction. So the Central Oregon plan, shared care, is the only plan that is still in existence. We're doing some other things in Lane County. So.
And this will be pretty much cleaned up. It sounds like that's the population that we're aiming at with the subsidies and the.
Right.
Are there other questions? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2280. Are you prepared to work this bill? Any problems?
Yeah.
Okay. Open a work session. House Bill 2280.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2280 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2280 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, I could be supportive of this only if I get to hear Representative Conger explain it the way he explained it to us the first time on the House floor.
He seemed like the perfect person to carry the bill.
That's good punishment, I think, instead. That's good.
I thought that was punishment for you.
I want to endure it twice.
Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Plan.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Parker.
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Whitener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Katie Geyer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson.
Aye.
And Chair Relay.
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2280 goes to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Carried by Representative Conger, who's learned a lot in the last few minutes. While we have...
Can we get Representative Hoyle to sit with him that day?
We could punish her by making her a co-carrier, but I don't think
that's who was bending my ear out there. She had me. You're going to vote yes, right?
Can I have a motion to suspend the rules and allow...
Mr. Chair, I
three members.
Move that we suspend the rules to allow Representative Harker, Clem, and Widener to vote on the bills 2691.
House Bill 2691. Representative Thompson moves we suspend the rules to allow three of our members to vote on House Bill 2691. Hearing no objections, so moved. Would you call the roll, the rest of the roll on 2691, please?
Representative.
I am.
Yes.
Whatever his name is.
And I'm sorry.
Clem Kenny Geyer and Widener.
No, not Kenny Geyer.
No. Clem Harker Widener.
Clem Harker Widener.
Clem Harker and Widener.
There we go.
That's right. You were here.
The three stooges who are gone.
Mm-hmm.
Slackers.
Harker next.
Hillary.
Oh.
Oh, I did.
He we're all done. Okay.
Oh, what about Widener?
Did you call me?
Aye.
Sure.
There you go.
Okay. It's all ayes. The ayes have it. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2740. And who do we have? Yes, please introduce it. Thank you for reading.
House Bill 2740 authorizes the State Board of Pharmacy to waive requirements for distribution of prescription drugs under the Charitable Prescription Drug Program if the board determines that the waiver is in the interest of public health and safety.
We have Gary Schnabel who join us, and Erica Hendricks for Representative Gelser. Erica, why don't you start?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erica Hendricks. I am the legislative aide for Representative Gelser, who represents House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. She's unfortunately unable to be here today because she's next door chairing the Education Committee. However, she wanted me to give you a little bit of background about HB 2740 and urge your support. In 2009, we passed legislation creating a charitable pharmacy program. The idea came from a constituent of hers who was frustrated that her medicine cabinet had expensive leftover cancer drugs and she had to destroy while other members of her support group went untreated because the medications were too expensive and they were because they were uninsured or underinsured. She thought that there should be a way to reduce waste and improve access. With the help of the board, the Board of Pharmacy and this committee, we passed HB 2535, which established a stringent patient safety standards to ensure the program would be safe and allowed sealed, unused prescriptions to be redistributed through a pharmacy. I'm pleased to report that the program is doing very well. There are currently 5 pharmacies that have volunteered to participate, and hopefully even more pharmacies will join. Recently, Representative Gelser was approached by a constituent of hers, Penny Rare, who is a professor in the OSU College of Pharmacy and a member of the Board of Pharmacy. She indicated that the program would be strengthened by giving the board a little bit more discretion around the drug handling requirements. In the implementation of this legislation, the board has, there are circumstances where medications may be safely redistributed, but the statutory language is too stringent to allow them to take these safe actions that will reduce waste and improve access for uninsured and underinsured Oregonians. HB 2740 will allow the board limited discretion to make these improvements to the program while preserving patient safety. Gary Schnabel and perhaps Gary Miner are here today to talk to you about the details of this discretion and how it'll improve patient care. Rep. Gelser, thanks you for scheduling this hearing, and looks forward to seeing this, to working with you and move this bill forward.
Hey. I'm Gary Schnabel. I'm executive director for the Board of Pharmacy. Gary Miner was not able to be here today. He thought he would, but he's stuck in the office.
You can handle it.
I can handle it. Somebody has to work there. He is the director of compliance for the Board of Pharmacy, and he worked closely, as did I, with Representative Gelser in 2009 when the original bill was put together. She said most of what I had to say. It's good news about the program. It's working well. We actually now have 11 pharmacies in the program. It's been updated since then. I think she got the number during a renewal process when all of the renewals hadn't come in yet. We have enough people functioning now in the program. We haven't had a single complaint about anything that's happening in the program yet.
And you're comfortable with this modification?
And with this modification, we're comfortable. I can give you a quick example of how it got here. There was a pharmacy, is a traditional pharmacy that's also a charitable pharmacy under this program. They have a regular pharmacy inventory and a small segregated inventory from donations in the same area. And they wanted to donate something from their inventory to the other inventory. Unfortunately, the containers had been open. And the statute says it can't be an open container, only a closed container. And when they approached the board, we saw that it was under their control. It was purchased from their wholesaler. It was simply a matter of transferring it virtually across the room to the other inventory, and we couldn't allow that because we don't have authority to grant a waiver to the statute. This would allow the board to grant a waiver upon request for something like that.
Great. Are there any questions at this panel? Representative Thompson, you okay with this?
I'm fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your coherent, cogent testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2740 and open a work session on House Bill 2740. Who's got the motion?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Is Clem outside?
I don't think he likes your committee.
I think he's got ADD.
Do you have a license for diagnosis?
We can get
I only need a license if I try and bill for it.
He can get free medication now.
Please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Hunger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Wigner?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Penny
Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Green?
Aye. Motion passes. Representative Thompson, will you carry this?
I would be pleased to do that.
Representative Thompson? Representative Gelser like to carry that, do you think? Yeah. Let's let Representative Gelser carry that.
I'll speak against it on her behalf.
Well, Just read that testimony. And tell the example. That's the, okay, excellent. Thank you. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2996. We have some testimony on it, but Representative Kifori, will you, I mean, not Representative Kifori. That's not anymore. Will you join us, please? And then we'll have
many years ago.
Who else?
I think he was a
Dr. Sabo.
Early 80s, I think.
Miss Volchev.
She came in.
And
I was gone for 12 years.
Johnny Culver, is that? Maybe. After. Mr. Hexer. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kifori. I'm here today representing the Oregon Association of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine on House Bill 2996. This is a very simple bill, Mr. Chair. It makes no changes in policy. It merely clarifies existing law. Section 1 restates that the practice of acupuncture has two elements. Those practices that only acupuncturists can do, and those practices that acupuncturists do, but other people can do as well. The first element is very simple, is Section 1A. Involves acupuncture, this insertion of solid metal needles for therapeutic purposes. Only licensed acupuncturists under present law, and as restated in this bill, can insert solid needles for therapeutic purposes. The second element, Section 1B, lists practices acupuncturists do that others can do, and Section 3 makes this more explicit in terms of listing those practices other people can do as well. That's essentially all the bill does. Again, it does not increase and does not decrease the scope of acupuncture in any way. Then why do we need the bill? I mailed you, I hope you've had a chance, or emailed you, I hope you've had a chance to read a one-page statement on dry needling. The so-called dry needling is a practice that a few individuals in several different healthcare professions have attempted to practice acupuncture by changing the name to dry needling. It's just the same as acupuncture, it just has a different name. This year, the Oregon Medical Board, which is the licensing board for acupuncturists, wrote a letter to two healthcare licensing boards here in the state declaring unequivocally that dry needling is acupuncture and it was illegal for those people who are not licensed as acupuncturists to practice acupuncture just by changing the name of the practice. The only exception to this is the historic exemption for MDs and DOs. They have universal scope and they can do whatever they want. We filed suit against one of these boards and we won a preliminary injunction at the Oregon Court of Appeals. Mr. Chair, licensed acupuncturists must complete a 3 or 4 year master's program with over 800 hours of study on the use of needles. Having people with only a weekend training session put needles into people and practice acupuncture is hazardous to the public health. That is why both the doctors in this legislature, Dr. Alan Bates and Dr. Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, support this bill. We ask this committee not change any law, but just pass this bill along to reiterate the present law. Inserting needles for therapeutic purposes is acupuncture, and only licensed acupuncturists can do this. And the only acupuncturists should do this in order to protect public health. You have a dash two amendments, Mr. Chair, which make only a couple of technical amendments. We had a little difficulty with Legislative Council getting the Legislative Council, and I know we've all been through this, to understand exactly what it was we wanted, and we've worked all that out. So the dash two amendments don't change the bill in any way. They only clarify some of the wording. Be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, would you do me a favor and tell me exactly where it describes the needle definition.
It's in section 1.
Page 1, line 10.
Acupuncture means a health care practice used to promote health and to treat neurological, organic, or functional disorders by the stimulation of, and we've taken out the word specific, by stimulation of points in and on, that's just to make it more clear, in and on the body by the insertion of solid metal needles.
It's the addition of solid metal at that point.
And we just wanted to make it clear that it is not injection of substances as doctors use with hollow needles. This is the use of solid needles, acupuncture needles.
And the function of this would be to prevent physical therapists and chiropractors, among others, from doing what they refer to as dry needling. Is that right?
Exactly.
Any other questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would those people who are doing dry needling be able to do that with hypodermic needles, hollow needles?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I'm not an expert in this. Look, what I've understood, what I've heard is that it would be painful.
More or less painful than solid needles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I've had acupuncture and I don't think it's painful.
Okay.
I'm kind of confused, I guess. If this has been an issue before the Medical Licensing Board, mm-hmm. and they've issued a, or asked for an injunction and gotten it, why are we doing a bill? Let me phrase that a little differently. I'm a little reluctant as a policymaker to get involved in scope of practice issues that are clearly defined by boards that are supposed to be doing this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, it's an interesting situation when you have several different licensing boards, each of which is independent, making its own decisions. The Oregon Medical Board, which licenses acupuncturists, made a very clear, unequivocal statement. They sent that to several different licensing boards. However, the Chiropractic License Board and the Physical Therapy License Board disagreed with the Oregon Medical Board. And there, one would think that the governor's office would somehow have a role in working out problems between these boards. That's not the case.
No, it's not.
Exactly.
Okay. I'm sorry?
Representative Conger.
Go ahead, please.
Representative Thompson kind of took my question. I might have phrased it a little bit differently.
Better.
No, not better. Not today. I'm wondering, you know, is there a health risk here, or is the purpose of this bill just to resolve conflict between licensing boards?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, that's an excellent question, and I think perhaps Representative Lively could tell you a little about that, as he related in the experience that he had. We think that it's very definitely a health problem. We think there are dangerous consequences. I wish I had an acupuncturist here with me today, but fortunately they're all back poking needles in people trying to make a living. And are not here today. I can get more detail if you'd like on that question. We think it can be dangerous for a number of reasons for people to be putting needles into other people without proper training. If nothing else, just for the sterilization and handling issue, which we spent more time on training on how to handle needles than those people who take weekend courses do learning about the therapy.
May I follow up? One other question. I didn't hear you mention, don't we have a board for licensing tattoo parlors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, tattoo artists are licensed by the Health Licensing Office. They do not insert needles for therapeutic purposes.
Thank you.
And they do not use solid needles. So they really are really relevant to this issue.
These are things that I would not know.
Let's start with Vern Sable and Gary Schultz. Let's start with those two, and then we have maybe.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Dr. Vern Sable. I'm a chiropractic physician in Albany representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I've been told to make my comments brief. You have my written testimony. We are opposed to this bill for two fundamental reasons. One, it redefines what acupuncture is, and by so doing restricts the practice of other professions. And second, at the same time, expands their scope of practice to include things which, in our opinion, are not part of their scope of practice, not the least of which is manual therapy, which, under that large blanket, can be high-velocity, short-amplitude thrusting procedures or spinal manipulation. So we are opposed to that, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Gary Schultz, I'm from the University of Western States. I think I'll echo what Dr. Sabo has said. You have my written testimony. Primarily, the institution is concerned about expansion of scope of practice that precedes demonstration of educational programs which demonstrate the competency necessary in those particular techniques and procedures. The second area, and that is gone into in some depth within my written testimony, the other area is the restriction of the use of solid filament needles under the rubric of acupuncture only. The university believes that acupuncture needles or solid filament 32-gauge needles are medical instruments, and they're used for healthcare purposes, and not one profession should own or hold dominion over them. It's the university's position that qualified practitioners should be able to use the tools of qualified healthcare and to provide those tools in helping their patients.
You teach dry needling at the school? I don't mean you. I mean, is dry needling one of the parts of the chiropractic?
Dry needling is available to chiropractic students as soon as the legal world gets done wrangling with it.
No, that's not the question I asked. The question I asked is dry needling a part of the curriculum of the university?
Yes, it is taught. Dry needling is taught in a more didactic format as a basic part of the Doctor of Chiropractic program. There's also an elective available to students which would, should the rules all go through with the chiropractic board, make them eligible to obtain certification to perform that technique when they're licensed.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
A quick question.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Can you tell me how many hours of training for the dry needling, both didactic and then also practice?
Sure. It's 12 hours for the elective program for the students within the Doctor of Chiropractic program. Mm-hmm. And the basis for that is that they already possess the vast amount of knowledge necessary in order to be able to understand what to do and how to do it. Mm-hmm. It's a question of actually getting specific training, using the tools, and providing the care. In other words, performing the procedure to competency levels.
Thank you very much. I call Laura Volchev, Johnny Galvez, is it?
Galver,
good. And Ben Backbear. Again, we'll ask you to keep it relatively brief.
Yeah. Do you mind if Laura goes first?
However.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Hello, my name is Laura Volchev, and I'm a physical therapy student at Pacific University, and I'm currently on my sixth of 7 years of education towards my doctorate in physical therapy. And I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association to express our opposition for HB 2996 in its current form. As a responsible and ethical future healthcare provider, I intend to provide the most efficient and equitable care to my patients so that they might have the highest quality of care at the lowest expense. HB 2996 is not founded on sound policy that is and is unnecessarily anti-competitive. I urge you to oppose it for the following reasons. I'd like to first inform you that as in physical therapy, we are experts in the musculoskeletal system and associated impairments. We do treat a condition known as myofascial trigger point therapy. And myofascial trigger point therapy can be treated by many methods, one of which is with an insertion of a solid needle. Myofascial trigger point release with a solid needle is one such tool that physical therapists use across the globe and in many countries in the United States. And they are safely performing this with the intent of increasing the efficiency and efficacy of the physical therapy treatment to lower the number of visits and cost of physical therapy for their patients when indicated. For over 20 years, myofascial trigger point release with a solid needle has been safely performed by physical therapists. And according to a report in 2012, the Federation's disciplinary database reports that in all jurisdictions, there are no incidences where a physical therapist has caused harm to it, requiring disciplinary action from myofascial trigger point release with a solid needle. Under our licensure, physical therapy scope of practice includes tissue penetrating procedure, including sharp debridement in wound therapy and needle electromyography. Under the basis that physical therapists have extensive education in the following: anatomy, physiology, biomechanics, palpation, and sterile technique, to name just a few of the qualifications for safely providing myofascial release with a solid needle. Thus, this is not a weekend continued education course. This is a technique that is building off of myofascial trigger point release within the study that we've been practicing for all of these years in our extensive education. Myofascial trigger point release is very distinct from acupuncture, as it is a means of improving myofascial dysfunction under the realm of the musculoskeletal system impairments. It is not advertised as acupuncture, nor is it tied to the roots of the practice of acupuncture. It is important to stress that the practice of acupuncture by acupuncturists and the performance of dry needling by physical therapists differ in terms of historical, philosophical purpose, and practical context. According to the American College of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, the Master of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine degree program is based on preserving the ancient theories, principles, and tenets of traditional Chinese medicine. The performance of modern myofascial release with a solid needle by physical therapists is based on Western neuroanatomy and modern scientific study of the musculoskeletal and nervous system.
Can you wrap it up, please?
Yes. So thank you. I would like to thank you all for hearing me today, and I hope that this continues to prevent the limitation of physical therapy in treating patients to our highest level possible. Thank you very much for your consideration.
Thank you. Please.
Oh, did you want me to speak?
Yes.
Oh.
If you'd like to.
Well, okay. My name is Johnny Galver. I'm a practicing physical therapist here in Salem. I'm also the secretary for the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. And I'm just here mostly to oppose Bill HB 996. And thank you, Representative Greenlock and your committee for hearing us. In regards to the use of dry needling, there's a lot of specifics that can get into who should be able to do it and who shouldn't. At this time, you know, our board has chosen to look into it and to try to get it approved, and that's where this question came up. The use of solid needles we've been a part of in the practice of electro myographic diagnostic studies, which is called EMG studies, in which they insert solid needles into nerves and muscles to listen for electrical activity, which then determines whether a disease process is progressing, whether it's present, and it allows the different physicians to get information to better diagnose what progressive neurological disease is approaching, or if there's some sort of contribution of nerve damage that's causing some problems. So it's the practice of using solid needles by physical therapists has been in effect since our board, our national board certified it, actually gave board certification to it in 1986. So we've been a part of using dry needles for diagnostic purposes and not for therapeutic purposes at this point. But that's changing all over the country and all over the world. There's a number of states and different countries that allow physical therapists to do dry needling. Do I do it personally in my practice? No, because I'm not certified. But if I chose to do that, I would go through the certification process. And so the opposition is that they're not the only ones that use solid needles. We actually use them on a regular basis for this type of testing.
Thank you very much. One more witness, is that all right? Very briefly, please.
Oh, yeah, it's very brief. My name is Ben Barber. I'm a resident of Portland, and my opposition is due to the fact that it declares what is an effective medical practice. And to my understanding of having read anatomy, physiology, and biochemistry books is that there is no known mechanism of action for Eastern acupuncture, nor has it been conclusively shown to be effective beyond a placebo effect. That's it.
Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2996. I think we're in a situation with this bill that you have one side that has one position and one side that has another position, and there's no hope of getting a compromise. So somewhere down the line, it's a matter of counting the votes. And maybe we can
open a work session, count them real fast.
I think let's talk to each other a little bit first, and we'll bring this back at a later time. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2902.
Public hearing.
I'm sorry, a public hearing. Excuse me. Yeah, no work session. 2902, and will you tell us what this bill is about, and then will you get, I think we have a witness coming up on the phone.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2902 requires insurers to reimburse physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners at the same rate as physicians for primary care services, and declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Okay, and we have somebody, we agreed to get somebody on the phone at 2:15, is that right?
Yeah.
Why don't I call the first panel, which is Susan King, Roger Fogg, who will be testifying by phone, and Simmons, is that right?
Madeline
Simmons.
You know,
let's start with that. And we're going to start trying to get Dr. Fogg on the phone.
I'm with you.
Or Mr. Fogg. Let's go.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. While you're reaching our colleague Roger Fogg in Grants Pass, my name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association and a registered nurse, also engaged in clinical practice.
Yes, the House Healthcare Committee for Roger Fogg, please.
Okay, just 1 second, please.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Let me make some brief comments because I'd like the bulk of our time to be taken by my colleagues in clinical practice as nurse practitioners.
We're just beginning testimony on House Bill 2902. We have Susan King talking right now, and you can listen in, and then you'll be next.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. For some of the members of this committee, you've heard a similar bill before during the last session. But briefly, this proposal is directed at the commercial health insurance market, does not affect either Medicare or Medicaid. The simple tenet of the bill is that payment would be the same for the same service, whether it's provided by a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, or a physician. Our best evidence is that about 300, maybe 400 nurse practitioners would be affected by this bill, but there may be more since the data is often difficult to obtain and is certainly a moving target. I'd like to be clear that the picture of health insurance currently and recent reimbursement in the commercial market is pretty inconsistent. Some carriers pay the same for the same service and would not be affected by this bill. Others have made reductions for nurse practitioners with no stated rationale and often no individual contact with the nurse practitioner. One of our members reports reading about it in a generally distributed newsletter rather than ever hearing from the carrier. Still others simply discriminate on the basis of license type despite the use of the same diagnostic and billing codes. The problem became most acute in 2009 when a carrier made a 25% cut to all non-physicians in mental health services, despite the capacity problems in our mental health systems that are well known. A second carrier, which then won the contract for the same population, made a second round of significant reductions to providers other than physicians. Obviously, there are consequences to access, particularly in mental health services where we have limited capacity at this point. Between last session and this session, we have narrowed our focus of this bill to services which are at the forefront of our efforts to reform health care, namely primary health care and mental health services. We all know that our capacity currently is insufficient, and with the addition in the very near future of thousands of new insured lives in Oregon, our capacity will need to be strengthened and has to be expanded. We strongly support payment reform. Some have wondered about this bill in relation to the current fee-for-service environment with all of its unintended consequences. ONA strongly supports payment reform that includes interventions such as global budgeting and capitation, of course depending on how those programs are implemented. So this bill is designed to serve to solve a short-term problem. We hope, we are certainly hopeful that we will achieve reform of our entire healthcare system and move to a much more rational payment system in the future. So again, this is fixing a problem for now. It is attempting to strengthen our primary and our mental health services, which are insufficient. Finally, we wish that this problem would have been solved by the carriers themselves. I'll be happy to answer any questions, and we'll defer to my nurse practitioner colleagues.
Thank you. And let's invite Edmund Wheaton up, since we have an extra chair there, and that'll be the four people signed up to testify in favor, and then we have a large number signed up in opposition. Roger, you're on.
Thank you very much for having me today. Chairman Greenleck, co-chairs Thompson, and Tanning Dyer, I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Roger Fogg. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I'm currently in my office, which is south of Grants Pass in Murphy, Oregon. And I'm calling just to support H.R. 2902. I'm an owner and operator of Applegate Valley Family Medicine, which is a family practice clinic south of Grants Pass. This has been open now for 8 years, and it's one of eight nurse practitioner-owned offices in the Grants Pass area. My background has been 33 years working in a hospital, including 25 years in the emergency room and 5 years in an intensive care unit. And I've worked for almost 10 years now as a nurse practitioner. When I first came to Oregon 26 years ago, I joined the Williams Fire Department because I had been teaching paramedics and testing them in the Southern California area. And I saw that there was a number of residents that were leaving the area because they had to be closer to healthcare as they aged. And so when I completed my nurse practitioner program in 2003, I opened an office to help meet this need. And this office now serves over 2,500 people from the Grants Pass and Applegate Valleys and surrounding areas. I became a nurse practitioner because as just an extension of my nursing work in the emergency room. I had a physician that told me that I could treat about 80% of the patients that were coming in if I had just had the right credentials, so I went back to school to do that. This office has been a clinical research site for the American Association of Nurse Practitioners about 6 months ago. In a yet unpublished study, they found that this practice site was seeing the same acuity of patients as the physicians were. And I hope that this study will be published soon. It was initially done in physicians' offices and now duplicated in nurse practitioner offices. I bill under my own name. I use the same billing codes as physicians. These billing codes are designed by the American Medical Association, and I have very specific criteria. So when I circle a particular billing code, I have completed exactly the same work as a physician would who's also billing that particular code. About a year ago, we almost went bankrupt. We managed to save the office by laying off a couple of employees, which was very sad, but the office is still open. We had about 15% cuts to our revenue from some of the insurance companies. It's made a big impact on this office, and I would strongly encourage you to support this bill. I'd be glad to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you. You can hang on as long as you can.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Thompson and Kenny Guire. My name is Madeline Simmons. I thank you all for taking time to listen to our testimony and consider nurse practitioners in the state of Oregon. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I have my own practice. I've been in practice for 7 years. In private practice, it's a solo affair at this point. So I'm a small business owner. You can read about my educational background. I've gone to graduate school twice, worked in schools, taught at the University of Washington, COCC, and now have a practice that serves people ages 9 to 90. My focus is with a lot of high school students and college students. My experience in educational settings makes it so that I'm fairly skilled at helping kids with emerging mental health disorders survive in their academic settings without losing too many credits. So I work with a student population. I also work with adults who have some complex physical illnesses as well as mental health issues. Today I want to address three topics. The first is a shortage of psychiatric prescribers who work with children in Central Oregon. The second is the new billing codes that, as Roger Fogg noted, really accurately, finally, capture what we do with clients. And third is the impact of the 2010 reimbursement cuts to my personal practice. So prescribing for children and adolescents. Since I've been in practice over the last 7 years, two child psychiatrists have left Central Oregon. And as they've left, they've had me come to their offices, and they sit down and they go through their complex clients, and they kind of turn them over to me with releases of information and say, could you take care of these kids? The kids who are less complicated tend to go to the primary care providers or the pediatricians, and I end up with some of the more complex kids. One provider left from Bend, another left from Redmond. And I'll mention I serve kids in Bend, also in Redmond and Prineville, and those are very underserved areas. There's like an 18% unemployment rate in Prineville, and there's a lot of need for people to serve kids in those areas. So I see complicated kids, and I also see clients who see psychiatrists. So sometimes mental health care really relies on a relationship with a patient, and sometimes that relationship is really good with a psychiatrist. Sometimes people find a nurse practitioner and it's a really strong fit. So our care is relationship based as well as what we prescribe for people. So the good news is that when we're looking at the acuity of the care of the patients we serve, we now have new billing codes. Since 2013, I can code my evaluation and management based on how complex somebody is and how many systems I review and how much I document. So the old billing codes were based on time only, and now these codes capture how complicated somebody is. An example is that I can have one lady who comes in, she's stable on her antidepressants, she's having some relationship issues, and I spend the majority of my time with her sorting out the relationship issues after making sure she's good on her antidepressant. I can spend an hour with her. Another client comes in who I also spend an hour with. She can be floridly psychotic,
desperate to kill herself with the guns that she has in her house. She has a history of significant suicide attempts in the past. And while I spend an hour with her, it's a whole different ballgame. And I'd like to be able to be reimbursed based on the acuity of the care. Not all of my patients are extremely acute, but some of them are. And I think it's fair that if I'm going to be in Central Oregon providing care to complicated kids and complicated adults, I think I should get reimbursed for that care.
Can I ask you to wrap up, please?
Okay. Finally, my practice took about a 25% cut from a couple of insurers about maybe 2 years ago. That's been significant for me in that I don't see as many complicated kids. Adolescents are hard to serve, and I've opted to not see as many of them because I can't see that many complicated kids and keep my doors open. So I've limited my practice. I don't see as many young people, even though I'm good at it, because of the reimbursement rates for those services. Again, thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chairman Greenlick, Vice Chair Thompson, Vice Chair Kenningwire, my name is Edwin Way, and I'm a PA, and I'm here to ask for your support for House Bill 2902. I'm a physician assistant, and I have my own practice in Oak Ridge, Oregon. Some of you may be aware of Oak Ridge. It's a very small town of about 3,500 people. The nearest hospital is an hour away, and as of a year and a half ago, I'm now the only provider in town. 5 years ago, a DO left town, and then a year and a half ago, almost 2 years now, another DO left town, and I'm it. I provide the full range of care. I have infants from 2 weeks old to I have my current oldest patient is 98 years old, and I provide the full spectrum of family care there. One of the things that's coming is a tsunami of patients, and I'm sure you all are more aware of that even than I am, with the Affordable Care Act and the legislation and the governor's initiatives, and we need to be able to provide for these patients. Doctors are leaving rural practice in droves. None of the Few of the MDs coming out of practice now are choosing primary care. They come out with a $300,000 mortgage, basically, on their education. So, of course, they choose specialty care where they can both pay for a house and pay for their education. I think that we should be reimbursed the same as physicians, not because we are as good or as lauded as physicians, but because for those of us that work in rural practice and in primary care practice, our costs are the same. I have to pay a mortgage. I have to pay for my medical office assistants. I have to pay for my electricity, my water, my medical supplies, and none of those providers are willing to give me a 15% discount. But the insurance companies feel that they can take 15% away from the reimbursement to me, and that I can just swallow that and still keep my doors open. My staff and I have carefully looked at what's going to happen to me if that happens. So currently, the bottom half of my reimbursements, if you take my reimbursement average, it's Medicare and Medicaid in the bottom half. This is the way it's always been. And like emergency rooms and hospitals, we carry that, and I put quotes around that, by getting a higher rate of return from our from our commercial insurances. If the commercial insurances are allowed to cut this by 15%, we will no longer be able to carry the Medicare and Medicaid load that we are carrying. And I think that's a crime, especially in rural areas. Oh, thank you so much. So, I've looked at the numbers. If I get reduced by 15%, I'm not very sure that I'm going to be able to stay open. It looks like I would have to close. The gentleman that was on the phone said he managed to stay afloat by firing some staff, and I'm sure I would reduce the lowest paying insurances. I would just stop seeing them. Once again, it's not about salary for me. It's about reimbursement to a facility. A PA that works directly for a physician also costs money. They cost overhead. They cost medical staff to support them. They cost medical supplies. And eventually the doc is going to say, I am not getting enough reimbursement to pay your salary. Are you willing to take a cut in salary? Some PAs will, but I guarantee you a lot of them will move out of the state of Oregon and will be short providers. And we have a huge number of patients coming down the line. Thank you so much, and please support this bill.
Well, thank you so much. We need to move on. Very, very briefly, we've got 10 more witnesses, 11 more witnesses, and we have 15 minutes to do this.
You're right about Oak Ridge being out there a ways. I've been there.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle complex patients like cardiology, things that in more urban area we might take for granted there's somebody down the street?
I have a wonderful working relationship with specialists in Eugene. Jay Chappell is a cardiologist that I can scan my EKGs to and send. He'll pick up the phone anytime and talk to me. The neurologists, the urologists, derm folks, I consult with them all the time.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call Lisa Trussell, Elise Brown, and John Powell. You all remember, we have 15 minutes. We have 11 people, so we'll keep going until we have time. We've got everybody with distance. Mr. Fogg, you gone?
No, I'm still present.
Would you like to keep listening?
No, I need to go see some patients unless you have some questions.
No, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's go.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. And for disclosure, in my real life, I'm a mother of an RN who worked hard to get her BSN and is currently enjoying a career in cardiac care. And I know at some point in the not too distant future, she wants to become an MP herself. And if she was sitting right here next to me, I'd be saying the same thing to her and her colleagues. Respectfully, that passing this bill is going to add costs to the system. It just will. This session is focused on implementing healthcare reform and saving money inside the healthcare system. In fact, Chair Greenlick, we look forward to having that discussion in your committee next week. We believe the effect of this legislation is going to have an impact on that effort. Simply requiring parity in payments is going to do three things. The incentive to utilize lower cost providers is going to diminish. Number two, it's going to increase out-of-pocket costs. And number three, increase premiums. The scope of practice between NPs and NDs is not the same. And although the coding may be the same for a single office visit, the work and intermediate office visit is just not the same when performed by an MP as compared to an MD. And that's because of the range of diagnostic training, insight, and experience. So we believe the differential payment is appropriate. We certainly all value the services provided by nurse practitioners and PAs, and especially understanding that as the mother of a nurse with a great future. And I believe we all need to work together to be ready for the increased access that we're going to need due to health care reform. But paying a physician extenders more money now is going to increase costs at a time that affordability becomes increasingly important. So I'm going to defer now to one of my members, Lisa Trussell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell representing HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon here in opposition to House Bill 2902, although I see that many of you have sponsored the legislation. Currently with my company, we do pay nurse practitioners as primary care physicians if they go through our credentialing process. And some nurse practitioners have gone through the credentialing process, and they're getting paid at the same rate we would pay a primary care physician. Other nurse practitioners, for whatever reasons, have not gone through the credentialing process, so we kind of follow the Medicare guideline, and they get 85% of what we would pay the primary care doctor. The one thing that has come up in this hearing again today, and it came up last session when we looked at this bill, is the rural areas, which is different than the metropolitan areas as far as availability of physicians. So I would point out, I believe I saw another bill in that addressed nurse practitioners' rates for the rural areas. And then the last comment I just wanted to make is, as a policy issue, if it makes sense for the commercial market, which has a fairly small number of Oregon residents that are under a commercially insured plan as compared to whether they're in a self-insured business or Medicaid or Medicare program, then it might make sense, if you're going to do this, you apply it across the Medicaid program as well. So it's not just targeting the small population that still happens to have a commercial product. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chair, we've been here before on this bill a few times, and our position is in opposition. We do pay some rural nurse practitioners the same as physicians, and that's, as Lisa said, through a careful credentialing process. I think it's important to realize beyond what Elise said about the reform of healthcare, that this bill does not necessarily mean in many, many cases that a nurse practitioner will be paid the same as a physician. But it will assure, if the implication is that we're to raise nurse practitioners' reimbursement to the same level as a physician, it will mean that our costs will go up. In a clinic situation here in town, Salem Clinic, they employ nurse practitioners. I think if you had them in here and asked them, do they pay them the same as a physician? The answer is likely not. So if we're required to pay a clinic like that for their nurse practitioner visits the same as a physician, then whoever controls the money in that organization will get it, not necessarily the nurse practitioner. So I wanted to make that very clear. Secondly, as was pointed out, insurance plans cover a minority of Oregonians who are covered. Federal plans, Medicare, Medicaid, cover the rest. Self-insured plans cover many people. So the bill as written would cover insured plans minus Kaiser Permanente. They're exempt under the bill. It would just cover those insured plans, but not self-insured plans. The only ones it would cover would be PEB and OEB, which by statute have agreed to cover all mandates. So it would cover PEP, OEP, and fully insured plans, but not self-insured plans, not Medicare or Medicaid. So I might just end with an example. We've had doctors of psychiatry, for example, testify here about how much training they have. And we believe that they get the toughest cases. And we just had a situation in my family where someone had an outpatient surgery and developed a very serious infection. The doctors were all busy. We were assigned to a nurse practitioner, a good one. That nurse practitioner went out in the hallway and grabbed a doctor walking by and brought the doctor into the exam room for backup in that particular case. I'm glad they did. It was a very smart move. And Regents,
you wrap it up, please.
Yeah, Regents does support the use of nurse practitioners. We're not here saying they're not good for the system and they do not do good work. We're just saying that once the legislature starts to do this, there is no end. And you know there are three or four other provider groups right behind these that want to do the exact same thing. So once it starts, you won't be able to turn off the spigot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I call Catherine Lucan, Catherine Fliegel, and Robert Luxinger? Did I get that right?
Luxinger. Hard H.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs Kenyon Geyer, and Vice Chair Thompson, and representatives. My name is Dr. Catherine Lucan. I'm a family practice provider at Salem Clinic here in Salem for the last 10 years. And I'm here today with grave warning in regards to this bill that you are reviewing. It's not because I have a strong uphold resentment against nurse practitioners or physician assistants. I've worked with them for my career, albeit over 15 years. I think they're a valid asset to our team. Having experienced the collaborative resurrection of the coordinated, the CCO, I need you to understand that there is more complexity to healthcare than this proposal that is in front of you. There are certain layers that need to be identified. The cost that you're looking at is one of concern, but more importantly, we have to continue to look at how are we going to provide the most utmost care to our providers with the most collegiate collaboration. I ask for you to review this with the question to you repetitively again and again, does this really solve our problem at hand, or is this a band-aid effect? Thank you, and I'll entertain any questions.
Chairman Greenlick, distinguished members of the panel, my name is Dr. Kathy Flagel. I am a psychiatrist for adult and children. I practiced primary care as an internist for 16 years. I trained medical residents. I'm now 14 years into my psychiatric practice. I supervise medical students, residents, as well as nurse practitioners. I am opposed to this bill and would ask you to think carefully about the assumptions that underlie the bill. I think that when the insurance companies cut the rates for payment for nurse practitioners and psychologists, I was appalled. I thought it was arbitrary. I thought it was wrong. I think the response to that outrageous act is to come back and ask for something more than what they had before. And I think it is inappropriate for several reasons. The length of education for physicians is four times what it is for nurse practitioners and family physician's assistants. I provided this in an email. I'll be glad to provide it to you if you don't have it. The cost of education for a physician, not counting the several years of residency, is at least twice what it is for a nurse practitioner for primary care or for psychiatric care. Furthermore, the underwriting assumptions for malpractice recognize a different standard of care for nurse practitioners than they do for physicians. For CNA-insured providers in our state, family practitioners have an insurance rate annually of over $8,000, in fact, $8,600. For internal medicine physicians, $8,400 a year. For psychiatrists, $6,000 a year. For nurse practitioners, $2,700 a year. For physician's assistants, $1,300 a year. The reason these rates are lower for mid-level providers is because the standard of care expected from a mid-level provider is not the same as a physician. Physicians do not go to physician's assistants for supervision. Nurse practitioners come to physicians, psychiatrists for supervision. It doesn't go the other way. So I would ask you to please look at your assumptions. The educational assumptions
and the monetary assumptions that underlie this bill don't support what I think is really fair, which is to bring nurse practitioners and physician's assistants back to a reasonable reimbursement rate, but not consider them as trained or having the expertise of physicians. Thank you very much.
We have time for questions. I'd ask why that difference in malpractice insurance may be a difference in performance. Yes. Please.
Thank you very much. Chairman Greenlich, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Thompson, and members of the Healthcare Committee. My name is Robert Luxinger, and I'm a second-year osteopathic medical student currently studying at Western University of Health Sciences in Lebanon, Oregon. I currently live in Lebanon, Oregon with my wife, who's expecting our first child later this week. So,
what are you doing
there.
Here?
Anyways, I speak on behalf of the Student Osteopathic Medical Association representing the osteopathic medical students of Oregon in opposition to House Bill 2902. My comments have been provided in the packet along with the comments of student Dr. Natalie Limoges. Since the inception of osteopathic medicine in the 1800s on the plains of the Midwest, osteopathic physicians have been dedicated to providing primary care in rural settings. For the reasons that that Ms. Limoges will be talking to you about the training differences, physicians are a vital part of providing primary care. But this bill will provide significant barriers that will prevent...
We have an extra 5 minutes, and we have another panel to go, so...
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That will prevent future physicians from pursuing careers in primary care. What this bill, House Bill 2902, would do would be to require insurers to reimburse nurse practitioners and physician assistants at the same rate for the provision of the same primary care and mental services. Mandating that nurse practitioners and PAs are reimbursed at the same rate will discourage students like us from considering careers in primary care. Though our extra time and training provides us with great skills to serve our patients, it also comes at great financial cost. Most of us will be graduating with over $300,000 worth of debt. House Bill 2902 simply requires that physicians and nurse practitioners are paid at the same level. It does not list what that level should be. While there's a chance that this bill would allow nurse practitioners to elevate their pay level to that of physicians, it could also present the possibility that physician pay could decrease to what is currently paid a nurse practitioner, making it unaffordable for us future physicians to maintain private practice, malpractice insurance, finance our educational loans, and support our families. We students believe it is unacceptable for the Oregon legislature to enact laws that will make it more difficult to provide desperately needed primary care. Myself, like many of my classmates, grew up in rural settings. We are dedicated to providing rural care. In fact, I provided you with 147 signatures of my classmates that are dedicated to providing care in rural settings. We think that this bill provides the wrong solution to the problem and could prevent Oregonians from receiving medical assistance from well-trained, highly experienced professionals. We strongly urge you to act in opposition to House Bill 2902. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, guys. Can I call Natalie Limoges, Mike Jasko, and Heather Knott? And I say for you osteopathic physicians, if we were here 40 years ago, you'd have been arguing for DOs getting the same pay as MDs.
Mm-hmm.
Same training.
And we pushed.
We have the same training.
Yeah, but we had, I mean, the condition was clear. Why don't you start?
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having us this afternoon. My name is Natalie Limoges. I'm also a second-year osteopathic medical student in Lebanon, Oregon. I speak on behalf of the Student Osteopathic Medical Association and representing osteopathic medical students in Oregon in opposition to House Bill 2902. I currently reside in Lebanon while attending school. As osteopathic medical students, my classmates and I undergo extensive training in order to become fully licensed doctors. Before even applying to medical school, I was required to complete a bachelor's degree. Mine was in health promotion and education, which I earned from the University of Utah. Many of my classmates also completed master's and doctorate level education before beginning medical school. I myself am currently in a master's program for public health while also completing my medical degree. I spend 60 to 80 hours every week learning and studying anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, pharmacology, and each body systems in order to completely understand how the body works. After completing my classroom training and passing my board exams in June, We spend 2 years in hospitals and clinics training under physicians in general, specialty, and surgical practices before entering a residency program. During residency, we receive 3 to 7 more years of clinical training, honing our skills for the specific area where we will practice. So prior to me being a fully licensed physician, I will have at least 20,000 hours of clinical practice. This is in contrast, we have 11 years, and in contrast to that, nurse practitioners have about 6. The majority of their education is in the classroom. They only have 6 weeks of clinical education, or 280 hours. Again, that's in contrast to our 20,000 before going out and seeing real patients. This legislation does not account for the disparity of time and additional training and experience that we receive to further develop.
I hate to do that, but I have to ask you to wrap it up.
Okay,
your petition,
that's fine.
And your written testimony.
So we do value nurse practitioners and physicians' assistants, and we recognize them as valuable members of the healthcare team. This legislation is simply not a solution to the problem. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll be pushed out of here by the next committee in about 3 minutes.
I will definitely try to be very, very brief here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Michael Jasko, DO. I've been in family practice for the last 14 years in Carlton, Oregon. I'm past president of the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon, and I'm the director of clinical education for Western University in Lebanon, for whom I speak as well. And we are in opposition to 2902, although, again, we believe that nurse practitioners and PAs are a vital component to our health care of all the Oregonians. This bill does not, well, for equal parity, doesn't help the situation. I believe that the unintended consequences are certainly decreased reimbursement, discouraging family practitioners to even come to Oregon if we don't train them here already, and obviously, as you've seen too, decreasing students to even go into the field, none of which we can have during a time when family care is needed so badly, especially with these CCOs coming to bear. And certainly no other, this whole bill is different in that if you consider journeymen, if you consider the military, if you consider even teachers in Oregon, we all believe that payment should be commensurate on experience and training. And again, if this is a Band-Aid, I think it's covering up a big infection that will eventually kill us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll keep it brief.
Please.
My name is Heather Knott. I'm a doctor. This is my third year in practice. I'm a forensic psychiatrist working at Oregon State Hospital. I moved from Texas in September, so I first heard about this bill on Tuesday evening at the Oregon Psychiatric Association meeting, and I think it's going to have a lot of unintended consequences. I mean, I think a lot of young physicians aren't going to go into family practice, psychiatry, primary care. It just won't be worth it. I think possibly folks will move out of the state of Oregon. Yeah, I think it's going to have a lot of ramifications that are completely unintended. My mom is a nurse practitioner, and I love her to death. I think she deserves great pay, but I just don't think this is the bill that's going to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks.
I think we've only missed 2 lobbyists, so we could hear from those at another time.
Mr. Chair, if I may make one small comment, since
yes,
I'm not on the bill. One of the things I noticed
time it takes you to go from here
that was brought up is we have journeymen electricians and we have electricians, and they both sweep up the floor. Do we pay the electrician less at that time? And they don't. I mean, you're paid for what your skills are that you've attained by going to school over time. And I think there's some very valid points that have been made here, and I think this is a Band-Aid we're putting over a large infection, as the doctor had said. So with that, that's my 2 cents.
Where's your... Thank you all.